This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
Hello and welcome. My name is Maura Fiedler, and on behalf of the Cops Office, I'd like to introduce you to Corporal Charles Fernandez, Defensive Tactics Coordinator at the Arlington, Texas Police Training Center. Corporal Fernandez is here to talk about applying procedural justice concepts to prevent unnecessary use of force situations. Can you tell us about the training you are designing on use of force situations and procedural justice?
Yeah, I would first like to emphasize that as a department, we've always placed a heavy emphasis on procedural justice and legitimacy, but we've also decided to apply these principles to situations where the officer was already using force. And in this area, there are two criteria that we use, or two goals that we shoot for. And the first one is, does the technique actually work? Does it do what it's intended to do? Does it end up with a subject in custody? Because if it doesn't work, everything else is a moot point. Nothing else matters, and we can't do that vital function of our jobs. We must have the officers prevail in their encounters and get the suspect in custody. And, of course, number two, when the officer does take the suspect in custody, when they actually do have to use force, does it reflect well on them, their department, or their agency, and police in general, when it's viewed by the community? Now, using these two criteria, we were led to focusing on techniques that are based on leverage. And that gives us two benefits. Number one, they work well for officers of all sizes. We could have an officer that's 5'4", 100 pounds, that may be called upon to arrest a 6'5", muscular convict. And there's nothing that we can realistically do to teach that 100-pound officer to be bigger, stronger, faster, and more aggressive than that bigger, stronger suspect, especially if that suspect is determined not to go to jail. So by utilizing a leverage-based system that doesn't rely on size and strength, we can give an officer a better chance of prevailing. And another benefit is that using leverage just looks better to those who may be viewing it from the outside, which would increase the chances that the community would be more accepting of it than they would if the officers were using more aggressive or inflammatory-looking tactics.
What made your agency decide this type of training was necessary?
Viewing various use of force incidents around the country, it became apparent that even when officers were 100% justified in their actions, that many times there was a negative backlash by the community, that they were not accepting of the officer's actions, which is understandable, because the average person in the community may be viewing it from a position of not being aware of the legal background in which the officer made the decision. Realistically speaking, the average person doesn't have time to study police tactics and use of force case law. And furthermore, they may not be aware of the background information that the officer had in that particular call that caused the officer to have to use that particular level or type of force. Because let's face it, when there's a group of officers striking a resisting subject into submission, no matter how justified it may be, it just looks bad. So we decided to see if there was a better way to prevail in our physical conflicts that didn't create a negative perception or reaction by the community.
How do you address officer safety through applying procedural justice tools to encounters with the public in this training?
Well, it's important to note that officer safety has got to come first. If the officer is killed or incapacitated, nothing else matters. The officer wouldn't be able to help anybody, the community. So everything we do has got to have officer safety in the forefront.
Now, in police tactics, it's widely known that the officer goes through certain physiological changes during high-stress incidents, such as degradation of their fine motor skills, the officer experiencing tunnel vision, or auditory exclusion, just to name a few. These are important. For example, if the officer loses their fine motor skills, their hand dexterity is severely reduced, which means they may not be able to operate their firearm or any of their other tools on their belt, or even use a radio to call for help. If they experience tunnel vision, which is where the peripheral vision is severely reduced, they may not see threats that could emerge around them. If they experience auditory exclusion, which is when they can't process what they're hearing around them, they may be physically able to hear, but their brain isn't receiving the message, then they wouldn't hear a nearby threat or any other vital piece of information. So while all of these are important and widely known, what is really interesting and not so well known, and probably the most important symptom, is that under a high level of stress, the officer stops using a part of his or her brain called the prefrontal cortex and starts operating with more primitive parts of their brain. This can cause several things. For example, this can cause pack behavior, An example of this would be at the end of a pursuit, and you have the suspect finally under control or even handcuffed, and numerous officers are crowding around him, attempting to get their strike in. Kind of like when predators in the wild have to get their bite in to achieve a sense of finality. While this is a very normal human reaction to high stress levels, it's one we absolutely want to avoid. Another common symptom of an officer operating with the midbrain is getting caught in what's called a feedback loop. And this is when they're stuck doing the same action over and over, like striking a subject with their baton, even though A, the action is clearly not working and they should transition to another technique, and B, the force is no longer necessary. However, the officer is stuck still striking the subject. Now, here's why this is so important. It's often said that an officer's greatest weapon or tool is their brain, which enables them to process all the information from a rapidly evolving situation and being able to adapt accordingly. To shut that part of the brain down puts the officer at a serious disadvantage. Now, here's the interesting part. The prefrontal cortex is also responsible for such things as cognitive processing, good judgment, calculating proportional responses, precision in their communication, and precision in their tactics. It's even responsible for moral and ethical behavior, which happen to be all the things that the public expects out of a professional police officer. So the same part of the brain that helps an officer fight better also helps them make better decisions, which is vital for legitimacy with the public. So the objective becomes, how do we keep the officer using the prefrontal cortex when physiologically humans are predisposed not to use it when they're overcome with stress? Now, there are two strategies that we learned from Henner Gracie, the Gracie Survival Tactics System, that we employ to help officers to continue to use the prefrontal cortex. And the first one is a positional hierarchy. And this is a system of assigning which positions in a fight are least vulnerable to attack and give the officer the most control over a subject. By being familiar with these positions, the officer will become less likely to be overcome by anxiety and thus more effective in the fight by maintaining that vital part of their brain, or at least the use of that vital part of their brain. The next one is energy conservation, which is another principle that enhances officer safety. By utilizing certain positions in this positional hierarchy, the officer is better able to maintain control by using just enough energy to complete the task, while at the same time allowing the subject to burn their energy, thus reducing their ability to resist or attack the officer. Because it's when the officer is exhausted is when the danger is the greatest. Now, the philosophy of energy conservation is different than what has traditionally been taught, which is for the officer to go 100% all-out effort for 100% of the entire fight until their opponent is subdued, what I like to call the bigger, faster, harder approach. While the thinking is valid, the problem with that is, what if the bigger, stronger subject is not subdued after 45 seconds or a minute and a half of a fight, and the subject is still standing and the officer is exhausted and is in the greatest danger of being hurt or killed, since the officer is probably not thinking with the prefrontal cortex at that time, they're also in great danger of making bad decisions. And, of course, procedural justice hinges on the fact that the officers make unbiased, prudent, and legal and fair decisions, which is, I believe, the fourth pillar of procedural justice. So the point is, we must give the officers the tools to be able to employ the procedural justice philosophy even under high levels of stress.
Can you talk a little bit about the importance of procedural justice and how applying procedural justice to escalated encounters can help de-escalate a situation?
Yeah, when we speak of public perception of these encounters, many times the public might be the very people who are bystanders witnessing the officer struggle with a subject. And often, they can be friends, associates, coworkers, neighbors, or even family members of the subject. And we've all seen videos of bystanders becoming inflamed and potentially escalating the situation because they perceived the officer or officers not being professional. And the last thing that officer needs is the bystanders turning into a hostile crowd. On the flip side of the coin, we've seen videos of friends and family members of the subject actually telling the subject to stop resisting the officer and let the officer do their job. So, by employing the leverage-based techniques that appear benign and effectively and professionally communicating to the suspect, communicating to the other officers, communicating even to the crowd, the officers will appear more professional and that they're using force because they have to rather than because they're mad or for some other reason that the crowd might perceive.
And, of course, this is the fact that we think would gain the most amount of acceptance from the viewing public that could be instrumental in de-escalating an already escalated situation.
Not every encounter can be de-escalated. When force is necessary, what tips do you have for law enforcement?
My advice would be to become familiar with the mechanics of a fight, to know which positions you want to avoid and which ones you want to try to achieve. This will help slow the fight down for the officer, and like we've already discussed, will help keep the officer's anxiety in check. Mental rehearsal is very beneficial. The way an officer can utilize this is to visualize a certain scenario ahead of time and go through the various options that he or she may have in that particular scenario, and just run through those options and apply maybe what could be best be described as a filter or benchmarks to check the efficacy, the validity of those options. And we have something we call the 7 benchmarks to evaluate police enforcement action. And it's a series of 7 questions designed to evaluate a police action. And I'll just run through them real quick so the listeners have kind of an idea. And they are, number 1 is, was the action a just cause? The next one is, was there right authority? The 3rd one was there right intention? The 4th one is, were the ends and means proportional? The 5th one is, was the action a last resort? The 6th one is, was there a reasonable hope of success? And the last one is, was the action a reasonable preservation or restoration of civil order? So as the officer runs through these hypothetical actions through a filter such as the 7 benchmarks, they can kind of sort out the details ahead of time. So when the fight actually occurs, he or she has certain solutions pre-programmed in place. Or in other words, they already have them in the procedural memory. A good example of what procedural memory is let's say driving a car. When you first learned how to drive, you probably didn't know any of the tasks that you are now taking for granted, such as how to put the vehicle in gear, how to turn, how to put your turn signal on, how to adjust and check your mirrors, starting, stopping, etc. But then, after a while, this all becomes a second nature or part of your procedural memory, so you don't have to think about it anymore. You can just concentrate on the changing conditions of the road and the traffic around you. So let's say if a car jumps out in front of you, you don't have to think about how to apply your brakes or how to turn, you know, or how to honk your horn. You just do it, and because you already made that decision ahead of time and sorted out those details so that your brain can just concentrate on the unfolding situation as it occurs. A good law enforcement example might be like working the domestic disturbance. When you're a brand new officer and you work your first domestic, the whole thing can be very overwhelming. The officer's trying to remember a seemingly insurmountable amount of tasks, such as separating the parties, sweeping the house for threats, getting the names and information, looking for injuries, running them for warrants, keeping your gun sight back, et cetera, the list goes on and on. However, after working a dozen or so domestics, most of these tasks become part of the officer's procedural memory. So the officers go into domestic, they automatically separate the parties, sweep the area for weapons, keep their gun sights back, and all those things I discussed. It's part of their procedural memory. So this frees the officer up to concentrate are the unique aspects of that particular domestic and what makes it different, which, of course, is much more manageable for the human brain. So I would advise an officer to practice mental rehearsal coupled with training to keep the prefrontal cortex engaged in the fight, which we achieve through being familiar with the mechanics of a fight. And this will not only help the officer prevail, but to help the officers prevail in a way that the community will support, which is so important because we can't accomplish our mission without the help and support of the community.
If other agencies are interested in the work that you are doing on implementing procedural justice, who should those agencies contact or where could they go for further information?
We have an ongoing relationship with the Center for Public Safety and Justice and periodically host schools in procedural justice. Charlene Moe and Dr. Kennard have been very helpful in what we're trying to do. We also have end-user training in defensive tactics, and we host the Gracie Survival Tactics Instructor School every August. I think this year it's August the 5th through the 9th. And we're scheduled to host the very first Gracie Survival Tactics, or GST Level 2 school, at least the very first one outside of their home academy, in November. I think the dates we have are November 4th through the 8th. And Hannah Gracie of the Gracie Academy has been extremely helpful with showing us the techniques that emphasize leverage, oversize, and strength. And we're in the process of making a video that illustrates the traditional method and the methods that we're proposing and kind of comparing and contrasting the two methods. And anyone interested in any of the training that we host or they have any questions, we're happy to help them in any way we can. If they just go to arlingtonpd.org and click on the training center, all of my contact information, all my colleagues' contact information is up there for anybody to get a hold of us through.
Thank you so much for your time and expertise.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.
The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.